This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The FBI, after being pressured by the public, released a more complete transcript of the calls made by the Orlando shooter Omar Mateen to police on the night of the massacre at Pulse, a gay bar. Earlier, the FBI had tried to redact the name of the Islamic State and other groups. Mateen seemed to have tried to hit all of the expectations of a so-called homegrown radical Islamic terrorist by citing perhaps every foreign terrorist organization he could think of to pledge allegiance to. Republicans and Democrats ran with the narrative that this was an act of terror right from the beginning, which is no surprise given the anti-Islamic rhetoric that has permeated American culture for many years now. A new report by the Council on American Islamic Relations, together with the Center for Race and Gender at the University of Berkeley, details the industry of Islamophobia that has been built up in the U.S., how well-funded that industry is, and how far up the government it reaches. Joining me to discuss it is Corey Saylor. He is the National Legislative Director of CARE. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, I want to talk about how things have changed in the U.S. I mean, it's certainly we've had sort of an atmosphere of Islamophobia for many, many years after 9/11 that ramped up. And then in the last few years, it's ramped up again. And I noticed that in your report, you found you've sort of identified a network of groups. And those numbers have changed over the past few years. An inner core group of organizations that kind of are part of this industry, and then an outer supporting core group. Tell us a little bit more about this network.
Sure. So what we did is we looked at a number of different organizations that we've seen using Islamophobic sentiment. And when you review the websites, press releases, activities of some of these groups, you can break them into the two groups, as you said. The inner core, these are 33 groups that we've seen who pretty much their reason for existence is to make people afraid of or hate Muslims. So these would be groups like Pamela Geller's American Freedom Defense Initiative, Jihad Watch run by Robert Spencer. The other group, which is made up of 41 different organizations, we call the Outer Core. So these are organizations who you see using Islamophobic rhetoric, but it's not their sole reason for existence. And the most obvious one there is Fox News. They give a platform to a number of anti-Muslim bigots, but that's not all that they do in their work.
And the money that this industry, this network of organizations have at their disposal is staggering. Can you throw out some dollar amounts?
So the 33 inner core groups that we were talking about, many of them are nonprofit organizations, which means they have to file their tax returns publicly. So when you review those tax returns, and we went through more than 500 of them for the report, between 2008 and 2013, those 33 groups had available to them at least $205 million in total revenue. Which means that, you know, their smear campaign, their campaign to make people hate Muslims, had a significant amount of finances behind it. And we talk about the impact in the report, you know, of that financing.
I mean, $205 million. I can't even picture, you know, organizations like yours, media outlets like mine, having access to even a fraction of that funding. And just to compare, I mean, CARE's annual operating expenses are just something like a few million a year, right?
4 to 5 million a year. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about what they do with this money. $205 million. Where are they getting it from? There are some large foundations, family foundations that are pouring money into this industry, this network of Islamophobic groups.
So unfortunately, there are some foundations, and some of them with names that I found a little surprising. Let's talk about Donald Rumsfeld's foundation. Not a significant amount of money, but that a foundation associated with Donald Rumsfeld would be giving money to anti-Muslim bigots is a bit troubling given that he used to be the Secretary of Defense. There's lesser known names, for instance, the Abstraction Fund. It's a foundation that's owned by someone who inherited some of the Sears and Roebuck family money. 82%, when we looked at the numbers of the money from that foundation, goes to some of these inner core groups. And then there's well-known institutions, for instance, like Donors Capital Fund, which is a fund where wealthy donors who want to remain anonymous can give money to the fund, say where they want that money to go, and then the fund itself gives the donation. To give you a sense, one of the largest ever individual contributions that anyone's been able to identify was in 2008. A businessman named Bar Sayed gave $18 million to a group called the Clarion Project to enable that group to distribute an anti-Muslim video to battleground states during the election cycle that year.
Now, the man you just mentioned sounds like he has a Muslim name.
I don't actually know what his background is. He's not a Muslim. We know that for sure.
So let's talk about what they do with this money. In many ways, this isn't just about promoting certain kinds of rhetoric. It's about actually changing policies. Let's first focus on the legislation that we have seen in many states and even local parts of the country that are attempting to undermine just the, you would imagine, the sort of religious freedoms of Muslims. What sort of legislation, I mean, how can you, first of all, legislate a religion, right?
So first and foremost, I think you made a very important point there. And that is that people, this is not just people saying mean things. This is people actually attempting to undermine constitutional protections of free religious exercise. And how it sort of evolved is to me quite fascinating as well. What they do is they sidestep the Constitution by introducing bills that say they're going to ban foreign law. The template bill that they use is called American Laws for American Courts. It was written by a gentleman named David Yerushalmi. American Laws for American Courts says we're going to ban foreign law. It gets introduced into state legislature. But when you look at the conversations that legislators have around it, it's very clear that the foreign law idea is a dog whistle because they always talk about Sharia and the threat of Islam to this country. And so far, that American Laws for American Courts, written by one man, David Yerushalmi, has been passed in 8 states, and then other variations of anti-Islam legislation have been passed in 2 states. For a grand total of 10 states, 1/5 of the country has enacted legislation that's intended to vilify Muslims.
And give us some examples of what those pieces of legislation are. I mean, if they want to try to undermine or say, you know, Sharia law is illegal here, how does that even work, given that Sharia law is not really a legal thing to begin with? It's part of a religious framework, right?
And it's also a false flag. So Muslims, like many other religious communities, Catholics, people of the Jewish faith, we sometimes will, when we have a dispute or have a contract to write, go to religious representatives so that it can be done within our understanding of our faith. And as long as those contracts that are signed are legal under the U.S. code, such things should be enforceable in courts. But what the actual impact of these laws, because they use foreign law, and the language that's in American Laws for American Courts specifically says, you know, is essentially that if anything that happens violates the Constitution, then that's illegal, is redundant because that's what the Constitution says.
So then essentially, are these pieces of legislation and these efforts at passing legislation a purely symbolic exercise?
To date, absolutely. We haven't seen any of these laws used in court at this point in time. So if you're looking for a vehicle to smear a religion and have leaders in a state say horrible things about a faith, this is a perfect vehicle for it, which is why we see it so often. When a legislature has used actually the term Sharia or the term Islam in one of these bills, it gets dealt with fairly quickly. Oklahoma is the key example because that's where it actually went to court. They passed a law in Oklahoma that said that judges in that state would not be able to consider Sharia or foreign law. We sued them, the organization I work for, CARE, 2 days after it was introduced. 3 years later, that law was deemed unconstitutional by an appeals court. And think about the Oklahoma area. This is not a liberal area, right? So that these were not liberal judges. So far, fortunately, we have seen the judiciary at least remembering what the Bill of Rights is about and making sure that Muslims, at least in that venue, get equal protections under the law.
And of course, it's a tremendous amount of expense at taxpayers, from taxpayers' wallets, if you will, to even have all of these moving through the courts, especially when the other side is so well-funded. Okay, so aside from legislation, what are the other ways in which the money is spent? In the outer group for the sort of supporting network of Islam, of the Islamophobic industry, are many media outlets. And you mentioned Fox News. In there is, you know, someone who's sometimes considered a liberal, like Bill Maher, Real Time with Bill Maher, but also people like the Rush Limbaugh show, etc. Does the money that you cite also fund these media outlets, or do they sort of bring their own money to the table?
Well, most of the media outlets we place in the outer core, and we don't try to quantify the funding there because it's simply impossible. Right. You can't really figure out how much it is. And the numbers become astronomical in that case. So really what you're looking at is anti-Muslim propaganda that's coming out through these venues. I'll go back to Fox News. Public Religion Research Institute in 2012 did a study of conservatives. And what they found is that conservatives who trust Fox News over other news outlets, that correlated with not liking Muslims. So something about watching Fox News tends to have a negative impact on people's opinions of Muslims. I would argue with you, and this is the case on why many of these different media outlets were included, because they give a platform to anti-Muslim actors like Daniel Pipes, Robert Spencer, Pamela Geller. And in our minds, that's the equivalent of giving a representative of an anti-Semitic organization or a white supremacist organization a legitimizing platform. And we think just as society rejects white supremacist rhetoric, rejects anti-Semitic rhetoric, it should also be rejecting this anti-Muslim rhetoric.
And so just to kind of step back, then you have a lot of these organizations like Pamela Geller's group, et cetera, with a lot of money they get from different sources, including family foundations. They spend it on helping to pass these symbolic legislation, piece of legislation intended to demonize Islam. They get on these networks and express themselves and reach members of the public, who then in turn become influenced and sometimes show up on the streets in front of mosques or protesting mosques, maybe pushing vandalism and possibly committing hate crimes and discrimination. Is that an important way for us to sort of look at how this works, this kind of world of the Islamophobic network works?
Well, I think an important thing to understand, and in your introduction, you talked about this a little bit, you know, what's the change been over many years? And we say that Islamophobic activity tends to go in cycles. So the last really bad cycle was in 2010. If you remember the whole debate over Park 51, what was called the Ground Zero Mosque, we saw a spike in episodes where people tried to push back against the construction or expansion of mosques. And we tracked about 50-something anti-mosque incidents that year. Normally, we will track about 20 anti-mosque incidents per year. Last year, we tracked 78 anti-mosque incidents, with the majority of them having to do with damage, destruction, vandalism, or intimidation. So the tone has really changed. It's gone from just trying to push back in city council hearings over mosques to people going out and trying to do actual damage to religious facilities. So these are things like a mosque in California that was firebombed, a mosque in Connecticut that someone shot bullets into it. So people are not just sitting passively taking in this anti-Muslim propaganda. Some people decide to take the law in their own hands and go out and make people they perceive as being Muslim pay.
You also identify in your report a number of individual figures, and we've thrown out some names already, such as Pamela Geller. And I want to get to some people who actually occupy office, elected office in this country. But there are figures like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, there's people like I mentioned Bill Maher, and some other folks who you point out in your report, who are the sort of stars of Islamophobia, if you will, who it's worth identifying for some of the hateful rhetoric that they seem to be spreading.
So there's two group. There's actually one group that I will really point you to at this point, because their impact on this election cycle has been troubling, to say the least. And that group is Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy, which, if you remember, I mentioned the name David Yerushalmi, who wrote the American Laws for American Courts bill. David Yerushalmi works there. The reason I've become so troubled by Center for Security Policy lately is, if you remember Donald Trump's call for Muslims to be banned from this country, in the text of Trump's press release, they cite a very flawed poll conducted by the Center for Security Policy. And then Ted Cruz, when he announced his National Security Advisory Group, three staff members from the Center for Security Policy were on that group. So this is a group that, you know, this is America. You have the right to say what you want to say, even if it's false. That is protected, and I stand for that. But I believe that such groups like Center for Security Policy should be at the fringe of any conversation. But what we've seen is they've been able to assert themselves right into the center of the nation's political discourse during this presidential election cycle.
So let's talk about the other aspect of this report, which I think is really important. You don't just identify the Islamophobia and the ways in which it manifests, but you also talk about how to tackle it. And actually, to pause that for a minute, I also want to bring up how schools are part of the equation. How has the hateful rhetoric against Islam impacted schools and children?
So to me, this is one of the most troubling parts of the report on a couple of different fronts. First of all, we found that two states, Tennessee and Florida, have changed the way they review textbooks for use in classrooms based on anti-Islam campaigns. So there's nothing specific in the bill that talks about Islam, but in each case you could see anti-Muslim activity and then the legislation getting introduced. What is being asserted here in many cases is simply teaching people, kids, the very basic fundamental facts about Islam is converted in anti-Muslim bigots' minds to indoctrinating children to become Muslims. So the five pillars of Islam, the sort of key beliefs, the first one is there is no God but God. Muhammad is the prophet of God. Simply having a teacher tell that to a student gets converted in the minds of some of these Islamophobes to indoctrination. And they then go out and challenge this. And that's the first point that really troubles me about this, that now what you're doing is you're trying to make sure that kids do not learn basic facts about the world around them, about a billion people. And that puts America at a significant disadvantage if our students are coming out of school without basic facts about what the world looks like. The second part that really troubles me, and this we included this in our study, but it wasn't something that we did. In California, the Council on American Islamic Relations chapters out there interviewed students, and they found that about 54% of the kids reported that they had experienced some form of religion-based bullying. So that's the second part to this. What is happening on TV with the election cycle does not just stay among the adults.
Right.
Kids are taking it to school and they're picking on other kids, which is really, to me, one of the most repulsive parts of what we saw in this report.
Right. And in fact, there have been specific reports focusing on the bullying that Muslim kids are facing increasingly in schools. A terrible development. I'm speaking with Corey Saylor. He is the National Legislative Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. And we're talking about a new report on Islamophobia that CARE put together along with the Center for Race and Gender at UC Berkeley. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're going to keep Corey on for an extended conversation about the report, which you can watch in our premium content section of our website. Corey, let's talk about how the information in the report can be marshaled to actually combating Islamophobia. This isn't just an informative report. This is a report that lays out a map or, you know, a pathway to digging the U.S. out of this atmosphere that we find ourselves in right now. How do you explain, now knowing the information that you know through this report, how we could combat this industry of Islamophobia?
Well, and thank you for pointing that out. CARE is an advocacy organization, not academics. So when we put out work, we always like to attach to it some kind of action that people can take. We don't want to just give you news that leaves you feeling troubled. We want to give you some way to deal with it. And what we had done, we published a report in 2013 called Legislating Fear, in which we first identified a number of these anti-Muslim groups. And we really focused on delegitimizing their work. And we feel like we've gotten pretty good at it. But to us, it just didn't reach the level of change in society that we were looking for. So let's call that a counter-opposition strategy, what we were doing in the past. What we're proposing in this new report is something we would call a counter-environment strategy. So you change the acceptability of anti-Muslim sentiment in society, and it's based on what we saw happen to the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan. Back in the 1920s, popular group, being associated with them was considered something to, you know, in some circles, something, you know, desirable. And today, still legal, but at the very much at the fringe of society, and what they have to say, nobody listens to. So that's what we're looking at in our report, changing the environment so that when these anti-Muslim groups get up and speak, nobody's paying any attention to them because they're not considered legitimate. And I'll quickly outline the four key points of that strategy. The first is, we believe that the Sharia, the Islamic religious principles, the two goals that are laid out in Sharia historically are be a benefit to humanity, avert harm from humanity. And I always like to point out, that's not be a benefit to Muslims, avert harm from Muslims, that's humanity. And I would argue to you that because the Muslim community has been in survival mode since 9/11, we sometimes forget those principles. So it's time for us to really start stepping up our alliances with other social justice movements, because that's what our faith tells us to do. So we're encouraging Muslims to get out there and be a more visible part of immigration reform, Black Lives Matter, humanitarian causes. If you saw the news coming out of Flint, Michigan, when they needed more water there, there were many Muslims on the front lines of making sure that happened. So that's one point. Second point is, we want to train more diverse spokespeople to represent the Muslim community. This is not a monolithic community by any stretch of the imagination. You have very liberal people, you have very conservative people. They should all be part of the national dialogue. So we're going to be making sure that people get a better understanding of how to project their voice into the public discussion.
Right. Even racially, the Muslim community is extremely diverse. In fact, I understand the largest racial group within Muslims is actually African Americans.
It breaks down to about thirds. African Americans make up about a third of the community, Southeast Asians about a third, and Arabs about a third. And, you know, also we have Muslims from every nation on the planet in this country. So the diversity is amazing. And I think that gives us an opportunity to have some really interesting conversations within our community. And hopefully that allows us to project some really interesting ideas to the rest of society on solving some of the nation's problems. So the last two key points to our strategy. First of all, we want to also, and you've already heard me saying this, we want society to look at Islamophobia the same way it looks at anti-Semitism, the same way it looks at white supremacism, an ideology that's disgusting, that should be legally protected, people should be free to say what they want to say, but should never be part of a mainstream conversation. So people have the right to say what they want to say in dingy hotel rooms that they've rented. It should not be part of the dialogue on the floor of a state legislature, right? It just makes sense to us. And then the last point, we want Muslims to become more involved in the public sector in the United States. You've heard people talking about that for many years, but I just don't think we've seen the gains that are possible of Muslims getting, you know, working on Capitol Hill, we're getting into the administration, being involved in effective political campaigning. So, you know,
or even running for office, right? I mean, we have like what, one Muslim congressman in the country, or maybe more?
Two.
One
from Indiana, one from Minnesota. And there truly need to be more, and not just in the U.S. Congress. Most that, you know, all politics is local. So city councils, school boards, that's, we need to have a presence. And, you know, based on that first point that I was talking about, be a benefit to humanity, I think that people that come from the Islamic faith have ideas that we should be presenting to benefit the communities that we live in. And you see that to a degree, but I'd really like to ramp it up.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Corey, for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out both more about CARE as well as the report that we've been discussing.
So the report can be downloaded from Islamophobia.org, and that will also lead you on to CARE's main website. But I really do invite people to go take a look at Islamophobia.org. We'll be putting the text of the entire report up there over the next few days. And, you know, let us make our case to you. See if you find our ideas appealing. And if you do, get involved with the movement. I believe it's very important that if you want to uphold the Constitution in the United States, we have to make sure that things that are going on, like attempts to take away the religious rights of minority groups through things like American Laws for American Courts, that's where the struggle has to be. I say Muslims are on the front line of defending the Constitution today. I'd like people to come and see my argument for that. And as I said, if they buy into it, join up and let's all work together.
The website again is Islamophobia.org. CARE's own website is CARE.com, CAIR.com. And the name of the report is Confronting Fear. Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Corey Saylor is the National Legislative Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.